Catch a name on the wall. Catch a name on the wall. Lord, help us all. Catch a name on the wall.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Annie and the Vets, and Touch a Name on the Wall to introduce today's show about the ongoing effects of the Vietnam War. Our regular listeners know that each year, for the last 5 years, the United States has welcomed a delegation of Vietnamese affected by the spraying of Agent Orange 3 decades ago. The fifth Agent Orange Justice Tour, as it is known, just ended in mid-May. It focused national attention on grassroots and legislative efforts to achieve a comprehensive assistance to the victims in Vietnam and to the children and grandchildren of United States veterans exposed to Agent Orange, as well as to Vietnamese Americans affected. Today I bring some of the voices from the tour, but first we talk with author Sue L. Jones about his long journey back to Vietnam after serving there as a young man. His book is Meeting the Enemy, A Marine Goes Home. On a lovely, warm morning in Berkeley recently, Sue L. Jones and I sat outside and talked of war and its long-term effects, and you may hear the birds, chickens, and passing vehicles in the background reminding us that life goes on and that that is a good thing. I want to welcome Sue L. Jones. It's good to have you with us today.
Thank you very much.
We are going to be talking about your book, Meeting the Enemy, A Marine Goes Home. I'm going to read from the cover blurb. This is a story about a young man who, with honor in mind, went to war for a country he loved and respected. He returned to the USA, a disillusioned young man who spent the next 30 years searching for answers to the question, why? Why did my country wage war against Vietnam, and why did I personally get involved? We're going to talk about that. Before we do, I want to tell our listeners that we're actually sitting in a very beautiful garden in Berkeley, and we're going to be hearing sounds of birds and all kinds of things, but we felt it was worth the pleasure of sitting out here today.
The warmth.
Exactly, and the warmth. So, Sue L. Jones, Meeting the Enemy. Let's begin with how you got to Vietnam.
Well, originally I got to Vietnam by joining the Marine Corps, which is... In my era, which was not an unusual thing because we had the draft, I was in the process of being drafted, and of course then I joined the Marines. That's my introduction into as a combat Marine. But I returned in 1998.
So you were there. What years were you there?
I arrived in May of 68, early May, and rotated out in June of 69. I was with Delta Company, 1st Battalion, 3rd Marine Regiment, 3rd Marine Division, and we were right on the DMZ area where the country was divided. And so what we actually were fighting was NVA, North Vietnamese Army, and they were a uniformed army the same as we were. And so we just basically worked up and down the DMZ, which is only about a 30-mile stretch from the China Sea to Laos. That's not a big, it's not a huge country. So that's where we did all about 90% of our work. After being country maybe 3 months, I really started asking a lot of questions, like, "What in the hell are we doing? Yeah. And you know, why am I here? What's going on now?" And when I left there, I was just really disillusioned. I mean, I didn't understand my country anymore. And what I realized 25 years later. I didn't trust anything anymore. I left as a young man who had no trust in his country, his ministers, his school teachers, his parents, his friends, and the worst thing, I didn't trust myself to make decisions because I had made a decision that proved to me to be totally wrong.
So everything was crushed in your
spirit. It took me a long time to even trust my own self to make good decisions. I had to rebuild all my foundations again.
So when you came back to the States, what did you do?
I tried very hard to be part. I tried to get back into being part of the mix, part of the average Joe, the working guy. And I was working, and a year later I got married, and I was going to settle down and have kids and a house. And, you know, the whole thing, well, it just never worked for me. Every time I tried something like that, it just got stranger and stranger. And I just couldn't quite understand what was happening. So I was, you know, married and divorced before I even knew what was happening.
And were you doing any counseling?
When I came back, that didn't exist. And so many vets like myself who came back, instead of going to counseling, we ran. We got as far away as we could from the VA, from mainstream. You know, everything that we thought was right was wrong suddenly. Said, no, there was no counseling, and if there was, we wouldn't have gone to it anyway. And they had the same exact problem today with Iraq veterans in Afghanistan. They come back so disillusioned. They say, why should I trust these guys again? And so they just run.
So one of the ways that you coped at that point was you went up to Alaska.
Actually, I just drank a lot of alcohol and smoked a lot of pot for many years. I was working jobs, and I'd quit, and I'd do another one and another one and another. And finally, in 1980, I said, this is it. And I just packed a little 1961 40 Conelon and drove from Texas to Alaska. Wow. And that's when I really just kind of disappeared into the mountains of Alaska.
And then at some point you decided to go back to Vietnam.
Yeah, I had been living up there, and I had a good friend, and he was working with vets, and he was also a Vietnam vet. And Mike finally told me, he said, look, you know, you can sit here and smoke pot the rest of your life, and you know, on your little acres of land, but you're not going to improve your life. Do something. So I started going to counseling then, and that was about 95, let's say. And then I finally went down to Seattle and went into the PTSD program. This was a 30-day program where you in-house live there. And by 1998, I felt mentally strong enough. I wanted to go back. It was my first time to return. And so Mike, his friend and I, he and I put together a package and we went back to Vietnam. And I really wanted to see the country. I realized as a Marine, what I saw was jungles. And I tell people I knew the 10 feet around me. That's what I was always watching. But I knew nothing about the country. Knew nothing about the people. So I said, it's time for me to go back and beat the enemy. Uh-huh. Of course, I knew who the enemy was. And it was me.
You knew that at that point.
We're always the enemy. Yeah, I understood at that point. And at that time, I realized I had gone through so much by then. And I had come to the terms, you know, that Vietnam didn't come to Ohio or Texas. I went to Vietnam, and I invaded their country. So depending on whose eyes you're looking through, who's the enemy? Well, I'm the enemy. And, of course, they were my enemy. And when I returned to the USA, my government was the enemy. And then big business became the enemy. And anybody that confronted me became an enemy. It's like I just accumulated so many enemies over the year. It was time to get rid of these guys. Mm-hmm. You know? And by going back...
So that was something that you were able to discover while you were doing the counseling.
Yeah, and of course, I've been writing all this time. I've been writing for 30 years.
Okay.
And I've got short stories and poems just stacked up about Vietnam. So when I started writing this, I had all this reference material that I had written early on. So by doing all this work, even with the drugs and alcohol, by doing all this work and I was taking acid, I was doing everything you could possibly do, and I just realized you've got to come to terms with this. You've got to somehow or another find out what really happened. And so that's when I decided to go back and meet the people, find out who are these people. And I think by finding out who they were, I'll find out who I was.
So you went back, and what did you find?
Oh, I found an incredibly beautiful country. People who invited me in as a friend, as a brother even. I've found people who are willing to forgive me. And I wasn't ready to forgive myself. But I thought, you know, if these people can forgive me, surely I can forgive myself. Mm. And what I actually came to the realization is that as far as Vietnam goes, I have one sin on my shoulders. I trusted my government to treat me in a just and honorable way. I don't mind fighting for my country, but if there is a true reason for it, like maybe in World War II, there was no reason for Vietnam. They lied to me. And that was my sin. I trusted my government. Once I understood that, then I started forgiving myself.
Sue-Ell Jones, this is author of Meeting the Enemy, A Marine Goes Home. People can get this book online.
Yes, on Amazon.com.
One of the things that we know about Vietnam at this point, some of us know about Vietnam, unfortunately not everybody, is that there's an enormous amount of toxic spread there, and the effects continue with the Vietnamese people. Talk about your realization about that side of Vietnam.
Well, when I was in country over there, we were sprayed all the time because that was the area I was in was a heavy sprayed area, and we were sprayed constantly. We were always told it was mosquito spray for malaria. Well, that's only logical. We believe, and you believe your country, you believe your officers. After coming back and studying and hearing about docs and hearing about Agent Orange, and I started realizing that we just really poisoned. We literally poisoned half a country, and we have absolutely done nothing to change that. And I saw that when I returned. I got involved with called the Vietnam Friendship Village, and this is a veteran-based organization in the USA. We raise money and support a small hospital for disabled kids.
Disabled from?
Well, we say they're disabled from Agent Orange. We can't prove this.
Okay.
That's the issue about Agent Orange. You cannot prove it. I have read where it takes like one part in a trillion to change the DNA of a mother. Well, how can you prove that? It's just totally unprovable. So once I got involved with working with kids, working with this Agent Orange issue, working with the veterans I fought against in Vietnam, and hearing their stories, and not hearing my stories or my government stories, hearing it through their own words, then I started understanding more and more about what we had done over there.
So that becomes a huge burden as well, beyond the burden that you hold for believing your own government. You've now become responsible for something that you barely knew about.
Well, nothing about, but it's still a responsibility. You know, if you're a clerk typist and all you're doing is typing all day, you're still guilty of killing 4 million people. If you're sitting in the USA writing orders to send bombs, you're still guilty. We're all guilty. I'm just as guilty as the person who sprayed Agent Orange because I supported it. So, yeah, I had to come to terms with that also, looking at all these children I met. Now they have met hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of disabled kids, severely, severely disabled kids. And that's my responsibility as a human being to give something back and make remedy for what I did.
And talk about how you're doing that.
Part of it was writing this book to tell my story, let people know that what happened over there was really brutal. And we have, each of us, everybody has to take their own personal responsibility.
It's not an easy message to get out there, is it? In a country like the United States, which is all about the individual, personal valor, making your own way and all of that.
And that's true. And what you say is so opposite to Vietnam, because Vietnam is nothing like that. The idea of the individual frontiersman is the dumbest idea the Vietnamese can ever think of. They're a social group. You're a communal group. And this idea of going off on your own is ridiculous to them. And when I saw that, it started opening my eyes to how what I had been taught and started changing, you know.
Mm.
And I realized that your community was so important. And over here we set community aside, make individuality the most important. In Vietnam, it's totally opposite.
In some ways, it's kind of an excellent way to keep people's minds controlled, isn't it?
But also, it creates this hero mythology, the great individual war, and it's all mythology. It's a way of building this idea that we can do what we want to anytime.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with a communal idea, you have to stop and reflect on your community before you make a move.
We're talking today with Sue L. Jones, and as you might be able to hear from the sounds in the background, we're sitting outside in a very lovely garden, and it's perfect to be sitting out here. I'm holding your book, Meeting the Enemy, A Marine Goes Home, and I want to just do a quick reading from preface to your book. Thoughts on War, quoted from Deng Ming Dao, a Taoist monk several thousand years before Christ. This is it. If you hold a real weapon in your hand, you will feel its character strongly. It begs to be used. It is fearsome. Its only purpose is death. And its power is not just in the material from which it is made, but also from the intention of its makers.
It is regrettable that weapons must sometimes be used, but occasionally survival demands it. The wise go forth with weapons only as a last resort. They never rejoice in the skills of weapons, nor do they glorify war. When pain, death, and destruction are visited upon what you hold to be most sacred, the spiritual price is devastating. What hurts more than one's own suffering is bearing witness to the suffering of others. The regret of seeing human beings at their worst and sheer pain of not being able to help the victims can never be redeemed. If you go personally to war, you cross the line yourself. You sacrifice ideals for survival and fury of killing. That alters you forever. That is why no one rushes to be a soldier. Think before you want to change so unalterably. The stakes are not merely one's life, but one's very humanity. Why did you decide to put this in your book?
The book was actually being published, and a friend sent me that, and I said, this is it. This is the story I'm really trying to tell. And that last bit is really what I'm saying. It changes you as a human being. It changes your humanity. And we send our boys over 18, 19, and now our daughters. And what we're doing, we're changing them as human beings, and they don't recover from this.
We also send them over there, and we don't really prepare them for what happens when they get home. So they come back changed, and where do they fit into a culture that itself hasn't changed?
You know, some people seem to do okay with it. I wish I could understand this. I have a good friend in Alaska. He was a Marine, came home, married, settled in, made money, and he's done okay. His son joined the Marines. He's dead now. He killed himself. He went to Iraq 2 years, on two tours, got discharged, came home, killed himself. Oh. So now my friend has two wars.
How is he coping with that?
It's by being who he is all the time and not changing. Uh-huh. By being the steady person and refusing to understand that it's his responsibility.
You are friends with him? You talked?
No, we don't anymore. We can't anymore. Okay. You know, because of his son. I can't approach him. I don't even know what to say. But, you know, if people stopped and thought a little bit about what he had gone through and the effects on him, maybe he would have been, maybe his son wouldn't have gone.
So he was really proud when his son joined the Marines and his son was copying him at some level. There's lots of stories of suicide these days.
When we came back from Vietnam, there was a lot of suicide. Alcohol and things of that nature. And oddly enough, unless you really think it through the whole process, it was the women. I think, and I could be wrong about this number, about 6,000 women served in Vietnam.
Nurses.
They had one of the highest suicide rates. Probably never saw combat, but they saw the damage every day. And I had a friend in Alaska, and I was talking with her about this. She said, everybody who came through the hospital, we're 19 years old, we're 18 years old, every boy that came through the hospital looked upon her as either a mother or a girlfriend. In other words, thought they wanted comfort from her. Mm. And she said, what we had to do was shut down all of our emotions and look at them as a chart. We do this like rebuilding a car and nothing, absolutely nothing else. And when they came back, they couldn't rebuild this again. And so they became isolated in their emotion. They killed themselves. Mm. So there's so many things that happen to human beings when you subject them to this type of horror.
Sue-El Jones, we know this at a real level. We know that this happens. It's just that we seem to prefer to go to war anyway. We seem to prefer to use our kids in this way anyway.
Yeah, I get amazed by this. I read a book several years ago called From Beirut to Jerusalem, and he had one line in there that really hit me as I read this. He said, until we love our children more than we love our tribes, we'll always have war. And of course, he was talking about the Muslims and Palestine and the Jews. They love their tribes more than they love their children. My parents, who are wonderful people, World War II vets, went through the Depression. They loved their country more than so they were willing to lay me on the altar of death. In a very honorable way. I'm not talking badly against them, because that's how they were raised. Mm-hmm. But they laid me on the altar of death without any real thought of what was going to happen mm-hmm. to me as a human being.
I find that this is one of the things that's been so difficult, being the parent of a soldier, former soldier. My son was a special forces medic in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it really bothered me that we were doing that. It still bothers me that we're laying our children on the line for some idiotic ideology rather than change the structure of the way the society works.
Right, yeah.
But that's not a conversation you can have with very many mothers.
Then you have to really start asking really tough questions.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's not a question that everybody who has a son wants their son to be a man in his own way, of course. We make the choice of how that person becomes a man.
But we have, the culture has such an influence on it. The movies that we watch, the hero, you know, everything is a hero.
Yeah.
Everybody is, you know, doing their own thing and succeeding and becoming vastly wealthy or whatever it is. That's what we show our kids. We have very little complexity about what happens if it doesn't work that way.
See, I have a, like, for me, I have a real problem with the word hero. I've got where I really dislike that word.
Talk about that.
We send these young boys over, and they say, oh, you were a hero. We were not a hero. They were doing a very hard job in a very hard way. And the reason I have a problem with that word, hero, because you have an 18-year-old son and a 14-year-old son, and you keep calling your 18-year-old son a hero for joining the military. Well, what's your 14-year-old son going to do?
Mm.
Of course. He's going to emulate, and he's going to join the military. So the concept of calling these boys heroes is a way of keeping the wars going and keeping the killing going. But it simply isn't true. The men who came back from World War II did not see themselves as heroes at all.
A lot of the vets these days have said that to me. You know, oh, I come back and people say, thank you for serving the country, and you're my hero, and things like that. And they can't really relate. So that's something that you ran into also?
When we came back from Vietnam, we were not heroes.
That's
we
right.
were villains.
Right.
We were baby killers. So we didn't have that same. But I read a book and called After Coming Out of Darkness, World War II vet, and he talks about his experience. As a postscript to the book, he writes how proud he was of the Vietnam veteran who came back. He said, we came back heroes. We did not scream. We did not yell. We did not tell people how damaged we were. He said the Vietnam vet for the first time came back and said, we're damaged human beings. Look at us. Look at us. Of course, nobody wanted to. We were not heroes. Now we've taken that and completely reversed it, and everybody's a hero. They're not heroes. They're damaged kids.
Mm.
They did what they felt was right. They didn't go to, you know, kill people. They just wanted to do what their government felt was right. But they come back damaged. And if you come back as a hero, you cannot say no to people. We were not heroes, so we could scream and yell. And these people, young men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, they're being called heroes, but yet in their soul, in their psyche, they know better than that. But they don't say no. They can't.
Mm.
Not yet. They will.
When you started getting into the Vietnamese communities, where were you? You were in which town?
We went from Saigon to Hanoi in 1998. And that's when while I was over there, I was introduced to the Friendship Village. So I returned to Alaska, did a fundraiser, raised $3,000, and flew back to Vietnam to make a gift to the Friendship Village. And finally in 2000, I moved over there permanently. So from 98, really, let's say 2000, I was working over there and living over there and watching these children. We also had veterans, North Vietnamese veterans, at that same facility. So I really got immersed into the whole society over there, invited into homes. And I started seeing these people as people. And I realized we really damaged it. And that just made me want to do more and more, you know.
And these days you go back regularly.
I normally spend 6 months there and 6 months in Alaska. When I'm in Alaska, I try to do fundraising. So when I go back, I can carry money with me for people.
Uh-huh. And are you seeing any progressive change going on towards our government recognizing the damage that's been done through the...
None.
No.
None. See, if we accept what we did and admit to what we did, the immorality of what we did, how can we hang Saddam Hussein? We did exactly what he did. We killed 4 million people. After the war ended, we had an embargo from 1975 till 1995, 20 years. People starved to death. They say another 2 million starved to death. We killed 6 million people. The whole world is outraged by 6 million Jews dying in World War II. Nobody ever talks about 6 million Vietnamese dying. Nobody even talks about what we did over there.
It's huge, isn't it, though? I mean, you know what your struggle has been just to regain your humanity. Imagine the level of a country having to come to terms with being everything that they have actually accused others of being, other countries of being. Iran is the current bête noire,
right,
isn't it? I mean, it's almost incomprehensible that a culture can do that.
Well,
can accept the responsibility.
Yeah, I don't know how you do that. I really don't know how a country does that. I'm not sure one ever has. I mean, even people in Germany today, some of the people will say, you know, we were right in what we did.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too hard to look at the reality and be honest with what happened. It just takes way too much pain to do that. And it changes your whole mythology of your country. We've always been the good country. And to find out we're not, well, that would maybe crack that facade we have, and it may destroy the whole country. Who knows?
Suel, if people want to get in touch with you to donate something to the Vietnam Friendship House or to the cause that you are involved in, mm-hmm, how do they do that?
Well, you can go online, and it's called the Vietnam Friendship Village, and you can make donations. You can go over there and volunteer work. Now, I haven't worked there in 2 years because I started writing, and I needed to get away and get my brain clear. But that's one way of doing it. I also am a lifetime member of Vets for Peace, and we have just recently, we're still going through the organizational process, we've created a Vets for Peace program in Vietnam. And so you can go, you could send money to Vets for Peace and ask them to send it to our chapter, Chapter 160, and then we will have humanitarian projects over there.
Okay, so that's Chapter 160, send it to Vets for Peace.
Right.
Or do a search online at for the Vietnam Friendship Village.
Right.
Okay.
And there are many, many projects, not just those two. There are hundreds of projects. You can donate money for food or, you know, prosthesis. There's a lot of things you can do if you start looking.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your story.
Well, thank you for asking me, because I want people to know we do have hope, but we really have to work at it.
Yeah.
It doesn't come easy.
Yeah, I mean, some of it means losing a way of thinking that is not easy to do.
You got to change who you are, how you see yourself. I don't see myself as a Marine. I see myself as part of the whole now.
That was Suel Jones, recently in a Berkeley, California garden. His book was called Meeting the Enemy, A Marine Goes Home, and you can find it online at Amazon.
I guess you could call it our summer of freedom, the year that we both turned 18. Fresh out of high school, we hitchhiked to Denver, thought we was a sight to be seen. That was the year that you dated my cousin, till they took us away in the fall. I surely wish that you were here with me as I touch your name on the wall. Touch your name on the wall. Touch your name on the wall. Lord, help us all. Touch your name on.
We turn now to the 5th Agent Orange Justice Tour to bring the voices of the Vietnamese who suffered the effects of dioxin-laced Agent Orange that was sprayed over vast rural areas of that country and over Vietnamese and American troops. First, though, a reminder that this is Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore, host of this weekly hour-long show. Our website is raisingsandradio.org. We're a project of Motherspeak and Motherspeak Media and fiscally sponsored by Peace Development Fund. Go to the website raisingsandradio.org to find out our range of progressive topics and download any shows for free. You can also purchase a CD of any shows, too. And please consider making a tax-deductible donation to Raising Sand Radio or Motherspeak at our website, raisingsandradio.org. If you make a donation of $50 or more, you will get a author-signed copy of my book, Long Time Passing, Motherspeak About War and Terror, and we will mail that to you with pleasure. Motherspeak also begins a project we call This Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live. It examines indigenous people and environments in Vietnam, the United States, Palestine, and in South Africa. We use the lens of industrialization and focus what is happening to these people and environments to learn what we can from them and what can inform more sustainable ways of living and making a living these days. We will share these voices and stories over time with you and ask you to become involved in the project too. Bring your ideas and imagination and collaborate with us, and you can email me again at susan@raisingsandradio.org to learn more about that. I begin the next segment with a poem read by San Francisco's Chapter 69 of Veterans for Peace. The president is Bill Creighton, and he will read the poem, and I thought it was such a lovely poem I wanted to air it here today. First, though, let me credit Jean Chass, also a Veterans for Peace member and a former veteran, for sharing this recording he did at the event. If you want a copy of the full event with all of the speakers, including the segments in Vietnamese with English translation, send me an email, again, susan@raisingsandradio.org. Now let's hear the poem.
I read a poem the other day by a Vietnamese poet, Lan Thi Nhi Da. She wrote this poem back in 1971. It has to do with the fearlessness and the attempt to survive, not by the combatants involved in the war, but by the civilians that have to carry on the day-to-day activities, the ones that are doing the chores, keeping things together. This poem is about a group of women harvesting the rice, and it's combined with falling bombs. The 12 white conical circles I refer to at the beginning refers to the hats that the women wear in the fields at night. They did their harvesting at night for protection. Most of the men were away at battle. And in this poem, it's been described as a playful, stoic, and an unafraid poem. So although it's in Vietnam, I think it also should be dedicated to all the people who are in war right now and to those that are trying to hold it together. The white circles of conical hats have come out like the quiet skies of our childhood, like an egret spreading wings in the night, white circles evoking the open sky. The golds of rice and cluster bombs blend together. Even delayed fuse bombs bring no fear. Our spirits have known many years of war. Come, sisters, let us gather the harvest. Each of us wears her own small moon, glittering on a carpet of gold rice. We are the harvesters of our village, 12 white hats bright in the long night. We are not frightened by bullets and bombs in the air, only by dew wetting our lime-scented hair. The last time VAVA, it's the Vietnamese Association of Victims of Agent Orange, were here, they were here seeking help from the judiciary. There was a long legal process trying to reach some type of agreement through the courts. Well, that didn't work, and now we're in the process of forming legislation to meet the need. Paul will have a little more to tell you about that in a moment. Agent Orange was discovered kind of by accident. Back in 1941 at the University of Chicago, in the botany laboratories, scientists and botanists were working on plants, plant growth. And the plants that they were working on, they kept dying. The plants would keel over. They couldn't figure out what was going on. Until one person said, you know, maybe this is what this chemical is doing. They were doing experiments with synthetic chemicals on plant hormones. So they discovered Agent Orange aren't herbicides, but they didn't call them herbicides at the time. They called them plant growth regulators. And so they discovered by accident these chemicals actually were defoliants. So they started making a lot of it, and before long, the Department of Defense heard about it, and they were starting to perfect its use towards the end of World War II. But it really wasn't used, I believe, until 1961 in Vietnam. And in Vietnam, these were turned out by the barrels. It was $7 a gallon. The United States sprayed Vietnam with 13 million gallons of Agent Orange from 1961 to 1970. There was a propaganda battle going on at the time because the United States was saying this was not harmful to people. And the Vietnamese, of course, who suffered from it, said, yes, it is. So I wanted to read a short piece from a book called Trespass Against Us, Dow Goes to War. During the Vietnam War, as charge and countercharge flew back and forth about Agent Orange's use and effect on the civilian population environment, the American military engaged in a bit of its own propaganda, using helicopter-mounted public address megaphones, blaring messages to South Vietnamese villages. One episode in Binh Dinh province, recounted below by Carol Vern Strum in her 1983 book called A Bitter Fog, is based on the account of a Vietnam veteran who took part in it. This is his story. Late in 1969, a young man crouched beside a 1,000-watt trumpet loudspeaker mounted on a frame that had been lifted into the helicopter. Beside him, another man readied boxes of leaflets, and just behind them, crew chief and gunner manned the machine guns on either side of the craft. The pilot brought the helicopter low over a small village at the mouth of a valley where two rivers met. A single two-story cement building dominated a cluster of mud and thatched houses. Buildings, paths, palm trees, banana trees, and dirt roads were contained within a concertina wire perimeter, separating them from surrounding rice paddies. As the helicopter circled the village, the young soldier swung the hinged speakers out of the cargo door and tinkered with the control panel of a tape recorder and amplifier. Grasping the strut of the seat, he leaned out of the open doorway to throw the leaflets his partner handed him, while a loudspeaker blared their message in Vietnamese in a voice clearly audible 7.6 kilometers away. And this is what the message said. The Viet Cong have been saying the sprays make the people sick and are making them sad, and that the sprays are killing the elders and the children. The Viet Cong are lying. They are poisoning the water, so the people will believe their lies. The Viet Cong do not like the sprays because they let the soldiers see where they are hiding. And I would like to now introduce Paul Cox.
Thank you. This is very gratifying that so many people showed up on a Friday evening for this event. We're very honored tonight to have this delegation from Vietnam. This is the fifth delegation that has come here as members of the Vietnamese Association of Victims of Agent Orange and Dioxin, and it's an important time in this issue. As Bill mentioned, the legislation that was filed in 2005 by the Vietnamese against the chemical companies went down and was unsuccessful as of March of last year. And now the Vietnamese people and their supporters here in the United States have moved on to trying to get legislation from Congress to pay the bill for the damage we've done in Vietnam. There is legislation that's being contemplated, and I'm sure this legislation will go through a great number of changes as it wends its way through the bowels of Congress. And hopefully what will come out of it is a bill and an appropriation and a structure to fully address the legacy of Agent Orange in Vietnam. Now, I'm assuming because everybody here is here, we all know a substantial amount about what Agent Orange, what the term Agent Orange means. But just in case there's a few people please, that don't understand, please bear with me while I go through a bit of history. As Bill mentioned, Agent Orange was sprayed for about 10 years from 1961 to 1970 over about an eighth of the area of South Vietnam and a significant portion of southern Laos and of Cambodia to kill the plants that were hiding the enemy from the United States forces. And I'm a Vietnam veteran, by the way, and we were told that this material was perfectly safe. It just kills plants. And I remember for months we were operating along the DMZ, and that area, much of it, especially the hilltops, had been between high explosive ammunition that had been expended on these hills for the last 5 years and multiple numerous sprayings from the herbicides had really totally denuded these areas, and there was hardly anything alive other than some invasive grasses, and there were no animals, no bugs, no nothing. You could operate for many days in a row in areas like this without ever seeing very many live trees. The herbicides, there were 15 different herbicides that were used. They were mostly variations on four chemicals, 2,4-D, 2,4-5-T, and picloram, and arsenic, or cacodylic acid, which contains arsenic. The 2,4-D and the 2,4-5-T were mixed in various portions, and the one that was most widely used was labeled Agent Orange because of the color that was put on the 55-gallon barrel that was at the manufacturer that identified it as a particular kind of herbicide. Another herbicide, Agent Blue, was the one that had arsenic in it, and it was used specifically to spray rice crops. And about a tenth of the herbicides that were sprayed, tenth of the total tonnage of herbicides, was Agent Blue, and was sprayed specifically on rice crops, which by any standard of international law is a war crime. And the Agent Orange, well, by standard, I think everybody here understands that it's a crime to kill a country and to kill the plants and the animals in a country. And that in itself is a moral crime, but technically it may or may not be a legal crime. But the spraying of crops to deny the population the sustenance that they need to live is in itself a war crime. But that is not an issue any longer. The United States has denied any responsibility on the basis of criminal behavior. They really claim to have acted in good faith within the rules and regulations and confines of war. The Vietnamese are not contesting that. But in the last 5 to 7 years, the Vietnamese government has come to recognize that Agent Orange has, or these herbicides collectively known as Agent Orange, have created such a severe health problem in Vietnam, and that the jungles and rice paddies that we so viciously damaged have not grown back, that they really have to move forward with making some kind of claim. They started with the chemical companies. As we said, that was not successful. Now we've moved on, they've moved on, we've moved on to the people that really do have the ultimate responsibility for this, the American people through our government and Congress. So we are working to draft legislation. There is other legislation that's being put forward to address this issue in a comprehensive way. It won't make it all go away, but what we need is to address it and fully address it. One of the things that we're doing within the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign that our chapter is a part of, and that Merle Ratner, who is here from New York, is a part of, is to get these cards signed. These are cards that will be given to our congresspeople based on our zip code And we will assemble these cards, and when we go to talk to the congressperson to put legislation down in front of them, we will hand them these cards. And hopefully from each congressman we'll be able to hand them 500 or 1,000 cards from their constituents, from their personal constituents, saying these are people in your district or in your state that think that this is an important issue that you should support. So we're passing these around. If please sign these. Fill it out as fully as you can. Especially we want your email, because we're going to be sending you notices of what we're going to be doing. And we need your name and your zip code and your address and zip code. The legislation that we're trying to assemble is going to address four items. The first item is cleanup. Do no further harm. The herbicides 245T had a contaminant in it. It was a manufacturing contaminant based on a profit motive. That is, when they manufactured the 245T, it did not have to have dioxin in it, but by speeding up the manufacturing process and jacking up the temperature, they could get the 245T much quicker. But what that did was create a partially catalyzed molecule called dioxin. Dioxin being one of the most poisonous chemicals known to man. And this dioxin creates practically every kind of cancer that you can think of in human beings. It also causes diabetes. It causes Parkinson's disease. It causes ischemic heart disease. It causes just a variety of other neurological problems, and everything from leukemia to sarcomas to the list is fairly long of diseases that are directly linked to exposure to dioxin. In some ways, more horrifically, it also causes practically every kind of birth defect that one can imagine. In children whose mother and father were exposed to dioxin. And it appears to be able to pass, it appears to pass down through the generations, so that even grandchildren of people who are exposed can be damaged. It appears to cause some sort of changes in the ways that the DNA is expressed, and so grandchildren and great-grandchildren can be damaged by it. In Vietnam, the herbicides are pretty much gone. Pretty much, except in some of the hot spots where they're very concentrated. But the herbicides kind of break down over time. The dioxin, however, is very durable in the environment. And it is extremely poisonous. In parts per trillion, it can create health problems. And it also is lipophilic, so that it collects in the environment and moves up the food chain, so that it winds up in the fatty tissues of animals that that have been exposed to it are eaten. And then it winds up in the humans eat, say, the fat of a duck who has collected the dioxin, and it collects even more strongly in the humans. But the dioxin is a durable in the environment. So the legislation will, first of all, do no further harm. It will be the purpose of it will be to clean up the dioxin in Vietnam. And that can be done either by containing the dioxin and isolating it, by moving it so it's not in a place where people can be exposed to it. People are animals. Or it could be by breaking it down, either by bio remediation techniques that are all very much experimental at this point, or it could be burned, which is expensive but effective. That is, if you raise the dioxin to about 500 degrees, it will break down into harmless constituents. That's the first part of the legislation. The second part of the legislation is to address the problems of the 3 million Vietnamese who are ill from Agent Orange. Many of those are adults. A disturbing number of them are children who weren't even born during the war. They have been born because of their parents' exposure during the war, or their parents' exposure since the war, or their children who were being exposed even since they were born. And I was just in Vietnam last month. We visited a hospital ward in Saigon where there are children who were 1 and 2 months old who are very messed up because their parents have been exposed recently. The third part of the legislation, which I haven't mentioned before, but Vietnam veterans are affected by this terrible legacy. And approximately 160,000 Vietnam veterans currently get assistance from the U.S. government for their exposure to Agent Orange. An estimated additional 150 or so thousand, perhaps as many as 300,000 veterans, will eventually be compensated by the VA. But what is not addressed by the VA for the veterans is the effects of dioxin on their children. And many tens of thousands of American children have been affected because their dad's or their mother's exposure and are getting no compensation and or no assistance. So the legislation will also contain an element for creating regional medical centers specifically for the children and grandchildren of Vietnam veterans. So it's item three. The fourth item is that if Vietnam veterans were affected by Agent Orange, and if the Vietnamese are affected by Agent Orange and dioxin, then it's very likely that the Vietnamese-American population is also affected, except nobody knows, and nobody has any idea what the general health situation is in the Vietnamese-American community. And so the fourth element of this will be a very strong research component to do a public health study, an epidemiological morbidity study of the Vietnamese-American population to find out what the situation is, to find out whether they are widely affected by their parents' exposure to Agent Orange and dioxin. And that could be very useful for answering very many scientific questions because the Vietnamese population in this country, Vietnamese-American population, has essentially the same exposures as the U.S. veteran population. And it would answer a great number of questions that are still up in the air about how much exposure was needed before problems are developed in both the veterans and in their children. So there are these four elements that we think are very important to fully address the Agent Orange issue. The major element is assistance for the 3 million Vietnamese that are being affected. That's sort of the background of the Agent Orange issue. I would really like to honor that that Ms. Ha and Mr. Ling came from the consulate to visit with us tonight, and there's a great number of other friends and supporters of this issue who are here today, and we really appreciate everyone coming. Our guests tonight from Vietnam are Ms. Nguyen Thi Hien, who is the chairman of the VAVA chapter, Vietnamese Association of Victims of Agent Orange, in Da Nang. VAVA started in 2004 with only 10 members. They now have 300,000 members in 54 of the 57 provinces of Vietnam. They are the organization in Vietnam that represents the victims in Vietnam. They are a membership organization and does tremendous work. And our first speaker tonight will be her colleague and our good friend, Mr. Pham Thay Minh, who lives in Haiphong. He'll be telling you his story, but Mr. Minh is 35 years old, and both of his parents were exposed to dioxin when they were sent south during the war, and he was born with a number of health problems and some physical deformities. He teaches English in Haiphong. Without any further ado, if we can please welcome Mr. Minh.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very honored to be here to tell, on behalf of millions of victims of Agent Orange in Vietnam, to tell about the stories. My parents were the soldiers who fought to liberate Vietnam. He was contaminated by Agent Orange when they were serving in the battlefields of Quảng Trị province in central Vietnam. But he had serious illness in his body. As a consequence, my father passed away of cancer in 2005, like many U.S. veterans. He left an unlucky family behind because my younger sister and I was born affected indirectly by Agent Orange from my father too. My younger sister was born prematurely many months before the expected time with congenial heart and lung. It's more serious when she got married. She gave a birth to a son, has a mental problem. So now in my family, we have a three generation affected by an orange. I myself suffered deformities and some severe internal diseases of liver, lung, and heart. From the pain, I have grown up. I tried my best to overcome every difficulties at my own pain, both in the spirit and body, to study and work. And I graduated from university. So now I'm a teacher of English. I'm very happy to teach English to the victims of an orange in our city. I want to share the sorrow and happiness with our victims. General Intai from, only in Intai, there are over 17,000 victims of an orange. Most of them are living in a very bad living condition. Yeah. So I think I'm very lucky, much luckier than many, many other victims of an orange in Vietnam. Because hundreds of thousands of children in Vietnam are born with a severe birth defects, thus they die very young. Many of them are born without limbs or eyes and have some mental problems. So they can't take care of themselves. They need assistance and support from their parents. Many women spend so much time looking after their children, and they have no time to earn living to support family. The diocese in the orange not only continues to sicken some generation of families in Vietnam, but also it poisons the land and water where it was dumped. They continue to cause serious damage to our environment and continue to sicken the people who eat the food in this affected area. So today we come here with my delegation with the expected that we call on the solidarity and relationship between the Vietnamese veterans and American veterans to continue the struggle for the victims of an orange, not only for the Vietnamese victims, but also for the American victim and the Vietnamese Americans living in the United States. We demand the U.S. government and the toxic chemical companies have to take their responsibility for what they have done in Vietnam. The U.S. government will surely cooperate with our government to sound the legacies of war. Through these activities, we want to enhance the understanding and relationship between our two peoples, Vietnam and America. I do believe that when we have the solidarity between the Vietnamese veterans and American veterans.
That is as much of the 5th Agent Orange Justice Tour that we have time to air. Again, if you want a copy of the full event with all of the speakers, including the segments in Vietnamese with English translation and representatives from the Vietnamese consulate in San Francisco, I have that, and I can put it on a CD for you and send it to you. My email again is susan@raisingsandradio.org. Learn more about the tour and also the Vietnamese Association of Victims of Agent Orange, also known as VAVA, at their website, which is vn-agentorange.org. And that is our show for the week. Join us again next week when we talk with author Ellen Hart. Meanwhile, visit our website, raisingsandradio.org, if you've missed any of our recent shows, or to make a much-needed tax-deductible contribution via our fiscal sponsor, Peace Development Fund. And Louis Armstrong will take us out with a reminder of how, despite rough times, he saw the world.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.